So this talk is called Yes and No. Sometimes in our life we say yes and sometimes we say no. And a lot of us have a bias toward yes because, you know, yes is nice, it's life-affirming, it's embracing, and we may be biased against no. Some of us also really like no. But yes and no are more complex than that. And I'm going to take a couple of 90-degree pivots in this talk, but hopefully it's all going to come together. So there's a kind of very deep primary yes in our practice that you might call the bow, the true bow. It's acceptance, it's open-handedness, it's willingness, curiosity, but it's not just ordinary acceptance. This yes is true awareness, complete acceptance, no flinching. There's resignation in this yes. You're not half turned away, the acceptance isn't provisional, not if or when, I'll accept it, but truly wholly accepting this is, that's the full bow. No matter what, this moment, this place, this body, this event, I accept it. That's, in a sense, that yes is our entire practice. But there's also a very deep no as well, and it's not no stop, no thank you, no I don't like this. It's this primary no of no self. No eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue. No separate intrinsic self. No permanent or separate anything. Everything is compounded. Everything is conditioned and dependent. This is no thing that exists by itself, including no path, no teaching, no achievement. Nothing unchanging. And our entire practice is this no self. And there's joy in that, just as there is resignation in acceptance. And our whole practice, you could say, is this no. So even if we become familiar with these deep states, we're still left with this question of how we function in the world. How do we help others? How do we affect change? How do we move forward? If I'm accepting everything, why would I work to change anything? If I understand how emptiness is the heart of all things, then why would I do anything? Another way to describe this yes and no is called prajna samadhi. So in traditional terms, samadhi is one-pointedness of mind, deep concentration, and we often experience it as a kind of profound, open stillness. When we touch that place, even if you touch it for a single second, you're conditioned by it and you changed. You're better able to accept the next thing you touch because of that deep yes. Prajna is wisdom, but it's wisdom that arises out of understanding no self. So that's the deep no. It understands the nature of the world as empty. When they come together, they're called prajna samadhi. And the ancestor who really promulgated this teaching is Wainong, the sixth ancestor of China. His samadhi is the joyful acceptance of oneness, the falling away of self-centered view. For just that moment, we are just experiencing, just being, without impressing our view upon the world. And it happens inside and outside of sitting meditation. Wainong's prajna is the deep Buddha, the broad Buddha eye that sees everything equally. So this deep, full awareness of samadhi interacts with this broad, clear view of prajna, and they are enlarged. And he said, quite famously, samadhi is the substance of prajna, prajna is the function of samadhi. And you could say that as stillness is the substance of wisdom. Wisdom is the function of stillness. We want both. Another way to say this is practice is enlightenment. Here's a long quote from Wainong. If you activate the insight of genuine prajna, in an instant, erroneous thoughts all vanish. If you know your own nature, with one realization, you immediately reach Buddhahood. Good friends, insight sees through inside and out, clearly penetrating. If you know your original mind, you are fundamentally liberated. If you attain liberation, this is prajna samadhi, which is freedom from thought. What is freedom from thought? If you see all things without the mind being affected or attached, this is freedom from thought. This is prajna samadhi, freedom and liberation. And for thought, you might think view, opinion, belief, and I'll come back to that. So this saying of Wei Nong, samadhi is the substance of prajna, prajna is the function of samadhi, was one of Kyogen's favorite sayings. If you knew Kyogen, you heard him say this. He often warned against the passive kind of practice that clings to samadhi and doesn't seek understanding. And he also warned against the toxic kind of practice that clings to wisdom and doesn't cultivate warm interrelationship. We have to have them together. Together they allow us to figure out what to do, how to react, how to behave in a wholesome way. So here's one of the pivots. Several of us recently took a long trip to India. India is a Hindu country, and Hinduism contains a system called Varna, which we call caste. There are, you know a little bit about caste, I'm sure. There are four main castes, but thousands of subcastes, and then another caste called untouchable. In Hindu practice, traditionally, the castes keep to themselves. They marry only within their caste, they socialize within their community, they follow professions related to their caste. It controls your family, your neighborhood, your career. And it's considered your karma. To follow the duties of your caste is considered your religious responsibility. Untouchable people call themselves Dalit, which means broken people. The Dalit are literally untouchable. They eat, sleep, work, and function separately from all other people. They're physically segregated. Their schools are separate, if they have schools. They're abused and bullied. They're disproportionately victims of violent crime and poverty. In many places in India, the untouchables have traditionally been denied water, health care, and other services. And yes, it is illegal. You don't have to say that it's illegal. It's been illegal for more than 60 years, but it's very active. In practice, discrimination is real and pervasive, particularly in politics and in marriage. People vote for a politician largely because of their caste. And very few people marry out of caste, even now. You see marriage ads in the paper by caste, just like it might be man seeking woman, it will be this caste person is seeking a person in their caste. And every once in a while, caste not an issue. You've probably never heard, though, of somebody named Dr. Bhimrao Ramji Ambedkar. In India, he's one of the most famous people in Indian history. He was an untouchable. He was the 14th child in his family. But as sometimes happens, a kind person from an upper caste sponsored him and supported him. Several people supported him to get an education. Eventually, he studied at Columbia University and got a PhD from the London School of Economics. He was one of the very first Dalits ever to go to university. He qualified as a lawyer, and he returned to India. He became the military secretary to the Maharaja, and later the first law minister after independence. But he was still untouchable. He was not allowed to eat at the same table or drink from the same well as his peers. He was not allowed to associate freely, and he didn't have the same legal rights. His assistants, it was said, would throw papers he needed to sign onto his desk, so that they didn't have to touch his desk. He was a contemporary of Gandhi. They worked together to create Indian independence, but they did not get along. They were like this. Ambedkar hated the caste system. Gandhi was a devout Hindu, and he said he wanted to free people from the negative parts of caste, but he believed in the caste system. So in a way, Gandhi's point was separate but equal. So Ambedkar was the primary author of the Indian Constitution. That's one reason he's so revered today in India. He's kind of the Thomas Jefferson of India in that sense. And he wrote a preamble that outlines the values of liberty, equality, and fraternity. That phrase, liberty, equality, and fraternity, is very significant to Indians. The Constitution outlawed untouchability. It gave everybody the right to vote, and it says all individuals are equal before the law. He also outlined a lot of women's rights, so women really revere him as well. But caste discrimination continued. And finally, Ambedkar just said, enough. I don't want to be a Hindu anymore. And he actually traveled around the world, and he talked to leaders of different religions, and he studied other religions and tried to decide what religion he wanted. He finally chose Buddhism. He said it was the most egalitarian, the most appropriate, and the least superstitious of religions. By then, Buddhism was essentially gone from India. There were very few isolated individual Buddhists. He got some help from some Sri Lankan monks to learn. By this time, Ambedkar was famous across India, and untouchable people almost, I mean, they just revered him like the most important person in their life. Millions of people knew who he was. On October 14th, 1956, with the help of these Sri Lankan monks, he went to a place in the center of India called Dikshabhumi, which means the place of conversion. There were 580,000 untouchable people there. It's amazing, amazing. He stood up in front of all these people and he renounced Hinduism in a very formal way and then accepted the five precepts of Buddhism, the first five precepts. And then he turned around to this 580,000 person group and gave them the five precepts. He had them renounce Hinduism. There's 22 precepts altogether because there's all these precepts about renouncing Hindu practices. And then they took the five precepts of Buddhism, and then he gave them permission to go give these precepts to others. They took the three refuges as well, and he said, go and convert. And 2 months later, he died. Today, that place is, I mean, in the middle of a very prosperous large city, that place is completely preserved. This huge empty space is preserved with a museum. So he died 2 months later, and that was almost the end of things. But a few other people stepped up, including an English Theravadan monk named Sangharakshita, you may have heard of. And over several decades, a sangha has grown out of this called Triratna, which means the three jewels. They have an interlocking system of sitting groups and little sanghas. They have 71 or 70 hostels for low-caste children and orphans. And they provide formal support, legal support for intercaste marriage. It's one of their primary goals, is to encourage intercaste marriage. And their motto is liberty, equality, fraternity, and justice. So it's hard to say how many Buddhists are in India now because several places in India have made it illegal to do mass conversions. They still happen, but they're supposed to not happen. The 2005 Indian religious census said there were 8 million Buddhists, but Indian Buddhists say it's more like 50 million. They're not counted in some states. I mean, there's just no place, no box to check that says Buddhist in some places. So now Triratna has a big training center in this place in Nagpur called Nagaloka Buddhist Institute. 15 acres. It's a lot like our place. They're still building buildings. There's still rough ground. But there's a long promenade in the center with an enormous walking Buddha. And how many people have ever seen a statue of a walking Buddha? They're very rare. He's taking a step, and he's all gold. And they deliberately chose this image of the Buddha moving forward, of an active Buddha, not a sitting Buddha. Thousands of people have trained in meditation there. They do a traditional Theravadan style, and they chant beautiful chanting. And they learn the basics of Dharma. And also hundreds and hundreds of young people have come from low caste and untouchable villages to stay there for 3 years and get a degree. They get a degree in Buddhist practice and Ambedkarite thought. He has his own body of philosophy. They renounce their Hindu past. For the first time in their lives, these people try to function outside of caste. outside of defining themselves by caste. And in India now, when you meet a person, you know, we might say, what's your work, kind of work do you do, where do you live? They are asking underneath that, what's your caste? In India now, if you say, I'm a Buddhist, that's the end of the conversation. Okay, you're outside caste. So another pivot, back. No matter what we think about the election, I think we all share the fact that we've had very intense emotions and opinions around the election and what's happening in our country. Most of the time, we're all overflowing with opinion. Wainan calls it thought. Whatever we call it, it's our view. We break that precept all the time. Do not become intoxicated. We break it with our opinions. That's the most soothing drug in the world. We don't even know how caught up in our opinions we are because for a long time, our opinion seems to be fact. This is the way the world is. This is what's right. The way I see it is the world. This is right, that's wrong. And a lot of our opinions have to do with the world behaving in a way that protects ourself, provides for the small self, makes me feel safe and comfortable. So it takes a long time to just get enough space around your opinions and preferences to see that that's what they are, that these ideas are conditioned, they're dependent, they're incomplete, they're relative. Oh, it's not a fact. I'm not always. My sense of right is not necessarily reality. There's a story about a Japanese Zen master named Nanen. And a professor came to him and to ask about Zen, and he had lots of questions and lots of ideas about Zen, and he just kept asking. Nanen silently served tea. And he pours tea into the professor's cup, and he keeps on pouring, and he keeps on pouring until it's overflowing. And the professor says, it's too full. Nothing's going to, no more will fit. And Nanen said, as you can probably imagine, you are like this cup. You are so full of your own opinions. How can I show you Zen if you don't empty the cup? So no matter how we feel about the election, one thing we have to do is get a little space around the intensity of it. The last week I was in India, Phyllis is out there being guest master right now. Phyllis Thomas and I spent a week at Nagaloka. We thought we were going to observe their classes, but in honor of our visit, they dismissed the faculty and told us that we got to teach. So, so with no warning whatsoever, we taught several hours a day to 30 of the oldest young people that are there, the third year students. Even after 3 years, they don't know a lot of Dharma. So we spent the whole week on the Four Noble Truths, karma and rebirth, and all in the context of a young ex-Hindu in India who's learning to find their way in the world. Now, wherever you go in India, foreigners are loved. People really want to meet you. They're some of the friendliest people I've ever met in my life. So you walk down the street and, where are you from? And then, can I take your photo? Can we have selfies? And I'm sure I'm in many people's Facebook pages now, but they introduce themselves, they want you to go home for supper. They're really friendly people. But they say, where are you from? And we say, USA. And they say, Trump! Almost always the second question had to do with the election. We were asked about Trump. We were told about Trump. Their lives are very affected by our politics. They understand how important this election is to the world. They pay attention to America. So every day, we were gone for the whole month around the inauguration, but every single day we had conversations about the election and our president and politics and what was happening back here. And we had a lot of conversations at Nagaloka about history and politics. The staff there are people who have spent decades in this form of Buddhism, were born as Hindus and have converted. They're very well educated, very thoughtful people, very blunt people. And they have names like Bodhidharma. And this man named Bodhidharma said to me one day, "You Americans are too passive. You must resist." And he's speaking out of this context of Indian history and Ambedkar's relationship to the Dharma as the only source he could find for liberty and equality. But Bodhidharma knows his Buddhist history. He knows where Buddhism began. And he's also said to me, "Buddhism is about social reform. Buddhism is for social reform." Since the day of the election here, people here have been asking, "What can I do? What should I do?" And many people have said, "What is the temple going to do? What is Dharma Rain going to do?" After George W. Bush's contested election, I think a number of us were here when, not in here, but over on Madison, when Keoghan said, "We will be a place where everyone is welcome." In other words, we will not take a political stand that shuts the door to anybody. This temple welcomes people of every belief. There's no means test to come in this door. But Keoghan held to this position for a long time. He once said, though, that he liked Zen because it had a place for ferocity, that you could stand up and protect something that needed defending. And so he changed his mind with Measure 9. Measure 9 was a statewide initiative that would have legislated discrimination against gay people. And Keoghan saw this, he compared this to the pink triangle that the Nazis made people wear. He said, "We can stand up for something with a certain amount of vigor, the upside of anger." And so the temple joined the community of welcoming congregations, and he gave several talks and went on public panels representing the temple on this measure. But in India, it was really startling to be told that I'm passive, that Americans, the noisiest, most demanding people in the world, are passive. But I knew what he meant. I did know what he meant. We have been very certain of our country. We have been confident in our institutions. The paramita of virya is this vigor that Keoghan was talking about. It means energy, vigor. Energy is what keeps us going. It's what drives us on, and it's the source of our activity on behalf of others. Energy drives us to work for justice. Resisting laws, arguing to change policies, these all have consequences. Just putting a bumper sticker on your car has a consequence. Any organization you devote time or money to, there will be consequences for you. Choosing to do and say nothing has consequences. You can't escape consequences. Virya has a flip side, which is anger and hatred. So perhaps we have really been too passive in this country, too sure of ourselves, too certain that our institutions are unchanging. We're being reminded that nothing is permanent. But as we step out and try to be active and work for change, for liberty, equality, fraternity, and justice, we have to be very careful not to slide into hatred. Hatred is the desire for something not to exist. It is other. It is not me. And there's a whole lot of ways to express this toxic kind of anger and hatred. It may just be aversion. Some of us, our first reaction was to hide, to withdraw. It may be cruelty or sarcasm. It may simply be separation. Not me. So we have to be very careful not to slide into this. But this yes of acceptance is not passivity, it's not quietism, it's not withdrawal, it's not turning away, and it's not refusing to participate. But this yes has to be tempered with the wisdom that comes from really knowing the reality of the world with no self, no permanent self, no permanent idea. Care must be taken. So what I want to leave you with today is to think about how you say this yes and this no at the same time as you decide what to do for the future. Questions and comments?
I heard égalité, fraternity, and égalité, fraternité, and the others, justice. But I didn't hear anything about loyalty, authority, sanctity. And those are things that are important to other people also. Mm-hmm. And so I guess my point is it's easy to have a preference and to not see what the other side finds important. I mean, I think loyalty is a big part of the caste system. And not to support the caste system, but we have to be careful as to how we dismantle that, because it could blow up. And then nobody's happy. Right. Everybody's suffering. So those things have to be dismantled more carefully. Mm-hmm. But
no, what Ambedkar did was, it really was revolutionary, and it was revolutionary in an explosive way. For these particular individuals, it's life changing for people. Mm-hmm. But they've chosen their battle. No school or institution or point of view is going to contain every value that we want to support. The school is run in almost like a residential Buddhist temple. They have very structured lives. That's one way they learn Dharma, is to follow this structure of meditation and class. But they're really being made into adults who will choose their own loyalty and their own authority. There's a strong value of self-reliance being built into this. So, I do agree with that first point that, you know, one way we intoxicate ourselves is to not listen, to not attend to what may be shared, what may be common. If we find out that we actually have something in common with our enemy, then it takes some of the fire out of our thing. We like anger because it makes us strong. We like to feel that way, especially if we're afraid or anxious. So by not seeing that commonality, we can stay, you know. Daisho?
To me, what's really tricky is that when we think some group of people are having wrong idea or wrong values, when we try to change that, sometimes it looks like we are like exterminating certain ideas or even certain people sometimes. And so how do we avoid doing that when we are thinking we are doing the right thing and then actually a lot of suffering happening, mm-hmm, at the same time?
Well, I'll speak for myself. I am working on not being sarcastic, not gloating. Not yesterday was a day when I wanted to gloat. Not jeering. Not making fun of. all these things. So I'm working on respect. I'm working on the value of respect. Because all those things are an attempt to diminish others and make myself feel bigger. And they don't help. You know, they feel good. They feel really good. They make you feel smart. But they don't help. So I would say that, you know, it's working for change with lots of energy, but also with respect. No matter what you're trying to change, no matter where you are, you have to do it in a way that doesn't diminish the other person's standing. And, you know, it's really tough because in politics there are winners and losers. So how do we allow that to happen without disrespect?
That sounds extremely hard to do.
Yes, I think we are in a learning process. I think there's a big learning curve going on. And when Bodhidharma said, you are too passive, I really did get what he meant, that we are not a country where there are millions of people marching in the streets and riot police. That rarely has happened in our country. In my lifetime, it's been decades since I've really seen that kind of thing. And so we're, in a sense, we're unpracticed with major political change. Where things happen a little more calmly here. So that's partly what he's saying is, Indian politics are pretty passionate, wild events. So they're really used to seeing strong opinions being worked out in the streets, and we're not.
Thank you.
Kaelin and Gemon and Sue. I was sure that there would be lots of comments today.
So on Thursday, Tyan and I did something that we've never done before, and we signed up to be to participate in the ACLU Lobby Day down in Salem. And so I've not been paying attention to my state legislature at all because of the national scene. And when I got my little assignment of the two legislators that we were going to talk to, I discovered they were from the opposite party as us. So I was feeling rather nervous, and, you know, also because this is my first time ever doing anything, and I didn't know if I knew what I was talking about. But we decided that we would just go and speak from the heart and do the best we could. And it turned out we were the only two that signed up to speak to our legislators. So it was our senator and Steve and I, and a ACLU person who accompanied us. And we had two people that were on the opposite side of the aisle from us. And I have to say, it was a wonderful experience because we focused on sitting across the table and looking at this person directly, who, regardless of our take on things, they are really spending their lives trying to serve in the best way that they know how. And once we recognized that, and also, to their credit, they recognized that we were coming to them as constituents with a sincere desire to have a conversation. There was no animosity. There was disagreement, but there was no animosity. And when we walked out, both of us felt this kind of warmth towards these two individuals. And I'm just so glad I did that, because I think it's so important to know that the people, in spite of what large disagreement you may have with them, they are people. And you can find some commonality in that, if it's nothing more than we both really care.
Right. So. You know, a lot of us in this room have participated in the dialogues with evangelicals and have had that experience of coming into a room sure of how it would feel and being very surprised to develop warm, lasting relationships with people whose religious beliefs are very different. you know, since the election, a number of people have said, why aren't we doing that with Muslims? We should be having dialogues with Muslims. But I don't know that we have a problem with Muslims. I think it might be good for us to have dialogue where people of different political parties are meeting. In that same way, potlucks and warm conversation. So that's really where our struggle is. We're all drunk on our ideas about what is right. Come on.
Well, thank you for this talk, Jiko. It's fascinating and very timely for so many of us. You know, after the Women's March was over, I went home and thought about, well, now what? What do I do? So one of the first things I did was I put Patty Murray and Marie Cantwell and Jamie Herrera Butler's phone numbers right by my phone. I live in Salmon Creek, Washington, and I have two wonderful senators, but my representative in the House of Representatives is very, very, she has a very, very different take on the world. And I decided I was going to start calling her office when I had an opinion about something. What I was surprised at was that there were warm bodies on the other end of that telephone. And I was intoxicated with my opinion. I knew I was right about fill in the blank. But I also was reminding myself that I needed to be polite to this person, that this person was being the recipient of a lot of phone calls. And I always was trying to, I have been trying to, because I have called, even this last week I made two phone calls, one to their local office and one to Washington, D.C. I always thank them for answering the phone, mm-hmm. because, boy, it must be really tempting for them to just let it all go to a voicemail. But also to thank them when I would hang up.
Yeah. And thank you for listening.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And sometimes it was just simply asking, can you put me in touch with the person that tallies the opinions that are coming in? And when they knew I knew the ropes, all of a sudden, lovely doors opened in that regard. Now Kian, thank you for giving me the idea. Now I'm going to call and make an appointment with my local office. But I've been having to remember that they are people, and thank you for talking about the respect, because I have sometimes forgotten that part during this period of time.
Yep. Yep. Good. Thank you. Sue?
Thank you for this really helpful talk and interesting. I love the part about yes and no. It's really great. And I was just thinking about how it is, you know, we try not to be too attached to our opinions and to know that, not to get lost in thinking that we're right and the other guy's wrong. And of course that's important, but it's important to not have that keep us from taking action and thinking about, you know, we take the precepts over and over and with the idea of non-harming. And at least in my tradition, every month we retake the precepts, acknowledging that we've broken the precepts because we know we'll keep breaking them. And we keep making mistakes. And Suzuki Roshi said, life is one continuous mistake. And so I think part of just being a human being engaged with the world is having a willingness to make a mistake, take a position, make a mistake, avow our mistake, and try to do better, but to not become paralyzed by the desire, by the thinking, well, everybody, no, nothing is perfect and nobody's right, so I can't really support anything. You know, we might go out on a limb and it might be wrong and the limb might break and we might fall down or something, but we have to take action and do the best we can, like people were talking about.
You know, one of the first things I ever learned about Islam is that they have a teaching that the kindest thing to do for your oppressor is to stop them from oppressing you. And that really resonated with me, that it's not, you don't become a doormat, you don't just You don't just accept. You also work to improve the world and the conditions of other people. And that actually is a kindness to everybody. It's a kindness to stop someone from committing a grave mistake. So absolutely, I mean, we absolutely have to take stands, and it's all about how we take a stand and what we're willing, what consequences we're willing to accept. Because there will be consequences no matter what. How are we on time? Are we okay on time, Genko? Okay, so time for a couple more.
Thank you very much for this topic. It's what I wanted to come to Sanzan with, but my body said no. Wait. So. What? The way that I've met people who are experiencing challenge in some way is with a deep sense of presence and just listening to what's happening, and also for what's underneath their experience, and meeting them there. And what I hear in the teachings is that. And I find it so interesting that recently my system is just like very strongly urging me to take a more active role, like you're saying. And so this week I was listening to the congressional hearing on healthcare, because an opinion I have is to get news from what's happening rather than someone's opinion. And what I heard is the conservative side speaking up for the people who are really concerned because their healthcare costs have gone up 5 times and they can't see the doctor that they've been seeing for 30 years. And the liberal side saying millions of people are going to lose their healthcare completely. And so what was happening in my system is feeling so much compassion and understanding for the people who are experiencing struggle with the change that's happening, not being able to see their doctor. But what I'm learning is to take a stand for the positive evolution doesn't have to be about making an opinion and making someone wrong, that we can still meet them in the needs that are there, holding that space, while saying, you know, education. Did you know that this is also true? Because what I find is, another example is, when I meet people who are feeling a lot of resistance, I don't know how to be with them because they really want to perpetuate that resistance while another part wants to step out of it, and it's confusing.
So sometimes our job is to witness. It's just to witness, to hear. Sometimes it's to represent. You know, if you're seeing a person who's very, very stuck, you can represent being unstuck. You can represent being able to move. Sometimes that's the best we can do. We can't, if we go into any relationship determined to fix and change things, I have discovered that doesn't work. I've tried that a lot. So sometimes what we're doing is just hearing, seeing, and being. Representing is to be your best self. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the way that I've been, and still somehow my system is wanting to I guess take that to another level is what it is, rather than just being and emanating that, but being that, like, honestly in a way that is more obviously shared.
It's one of the things we do. Sometimes we do other. Sometimes we march. Sometimes we make calls. Sometimes we vote. And sometimes we listen. And it's really easy to leave parts of those out. Everybody in this room has either a tendency toward passivity or a tendency toward activity, and that yes or that no draws us. And I'm really trying to talk about how do we find a balance here that's functioning in the world, functioning, but functioning out of this deep place. And to do that, we have to cultivate that deep place. Time for one or two more, one more maybe. Genko here, and so sets.
One thing I've been thinking about is sometimes I've noticed something inside of myself where I think that if I have the right views or even a compassionate heart or even the right stance on it, then that must mean that my values or whatever I'm shooting for is actually a true refuge. But then I've been questioning that actually that's a false refuge trying to find true refuge. And even when we're in the best of intentions, or I should say I, to personalize it, that's really still not the true refuges of the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. That even when, I'm really taking my own stand that is really right for me, it's still not exactly it. That a lot of what I do is going to change and move along. So I'm just kind of curious about that, like the false refuges we get into, not only as Democrats or liberals or Buddhists even, that just are going to vanish too.
Yeah. To take refuge in the Buddha is to take refuge in that broad eye that sees everything equally. It sees the true nature of the world. That is not a simple thing, and it's not located anywhere. It's not in your ideas, and it's not in your place. When we say we want to take refuge in the Buddha, we mean in truth, in the deep sense of how things are. And we have to find that slowly. Dharma is the teaching, that truth. But Buddha is the big T truth of how things are. And how things are is interconnected, continually changing waves on the surface of the ocean. And that's me and that's Donald Trump. We are all the same in that eye. We are all equal and we're all seeing the same. So if I take refuge in that, it's harder, much harder to separate myself and to set up straw men and be right and have them be wrong. It's much harder when I see that we're all the same.
One of the things that occurs to me in this back and forth, trying to decide what to do, how to respond, is I think for a lot of people, and it includes me, there's a sense of powerlessness, and that when I'm feeling powerless is when I most want to take control, to take charge, to fix, to control an outcome. And so part of what I think has had to happen for me is to have a different sense of what is powerful. And oddly enough, it's sort of counterintuitive, but what I find is that I need to step back. I need to see clearly. I need to let go of any attempt or even any idea that I'm right and that I can make things happen the way I want them to happen. And this sort of the wisdom of this deep not knowing. And to do that without becoming passive, without giving up, without saying, well, I can't do anything anyway, so oh well. But to recognize that there is something in there, something in between those two that really is
wisdom, and that really is true action. It's not a simple thing to conceptualize or to do or to make any sense out of. It's kind of it's an ongoing quest.
It does make sense, though, in that when you feel powerless, you're afraid.
Right.
And I think, you know, that was a very strong flavor in the Sanzen room and in conversations around here for weeks after the election.
Yes.
Was fear, anxiety, worry, and helplessness. It was a very powerful reaction that a lot of people shared. And that's where we go for anger. We go from there to anger and hatred because it feels so much stronger and more powerful. So I think it's really good to recognize that anger often comes out of fear and to go look at the fear. And now, you know, many weeks and a few months later, more and more people are doing sort of local action. They're talking to their city councilor. They're writing letters. There's a sense of, oh, there are things I can do, and they're not hateful things, and they're not destructive things. They're really, I can come out and be in the community and function. So, you know, right after the election, Kakamio wrote a really nice blog piece about it's a wound, and you have to, it's an injury, and you have to get over the shock of the injury. And we are now over the shock of the injury, and we're up on our crutches or whatever it is. It doesn't matter what side you were in the election. This was very divisive and painful. Everybody, whether your candidate won or not, we all were injured and somewhat harmed by the divisiveness of this election. So over the shock, you've got to get back up on those crutches and get walking, right? So, helplessness can be very toxic. And it's not true. It's simply not true. Every single thing we do has consequences. We're not helpless. I think we're at time, unless there's a burning comment.